Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Hubert Humphrey called Miles Lord the people's judge. A son of the Iron Range, he pulled himself up by his bootstraps and worked his way through college, then law school. He ended up a federal judge who ruled on cases that changed how America thought about corporate responsibility and the rights of the individual. He also was one of the founders of the DFL in Minnesota, and he considered Hubert Humphrey his best friend. He worked hand-in-hand with the likes of Robert Kennedy against organized crime and was in the thick of things during the world-changing 1968 presidential campaign. Here's something he said to us during a 1984 NPR interview.
Even when I was young, I've been reflecting on how I got to be so ornery. I didn't let big kids beat up on little kids when I was small. I defended them. I remember three Jewish kids were at Boy Scout camp when I was about 11, and I walked up there. I didn't even know what a Jewish kid was, but we only had one or two Jewish families in Crosby and Ayrton. I stopped those guys from harassing those kids, and the boys are lifetime friends of mine now. One of them is a lawyer in town here. But what makes me stick up for the underdog, I'll never know.
Miles Lord was a lightning rod for controversy. He was named both the worst and the best judge in the country in the same year, and accused by some of his peers of shedding the robe of a judge and assuming the mantle of an advocate. We'd like to hear your thoughts and memories of Miles Lord. You can join the conversation by calling 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. That's 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. You can also ask a question of my guest this morning, Roberta Walburn. She is a former journalist, a lapsed journalist, shall we say, who for the past 25 years has also practiced law, working on some of the highest profile cases in Minnesota history. She is also now the author of a new biography, Miles Lord, the Maverick Judge Who Brought Corporate America to Justice. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Now, you came to know Miles Lord first as a journalist, covering him as a reporter for the Star Tribune. But in the book, you actually recount how your relationship changed markedly one day as the result of a very early morning phone call. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. As with many things involving Judge Lord, and I often call him Miles because he had such a common touch. Most people during the day called him Miles, often followed by an exclamation point, and not the more formal Judge Lord. He did things in unusual ways, and I was a reporter on the Minneapolis Star Tribune, going to law school during the day and working nights on the cop shift, and really had no thought of practicing law. I was going to law school to help my journalism career. One night, I wrote an article about a decision that Miles had issued. And a couple mornings later, 5 o'clock in the morning, my phone rang, waking me up. I was working late into the evening, so I was pretty dead asleep. Pick up, and there's an angry man yelling at me. This is Federal Judge Miles Lord. He proceeded to ream me out about how I'd screwed up the story, told me I got the facts wrong, I got the law wrong. He was going to make sure that no one in town talked to me and was going to ruin my career as a journalist. And I'm struggling to wake up, and I finally get it together enough to say the standard line when you got irate calls, which as a journalist, which is thank you for calling. Could you tell me exactly what was wrong so I can correct it? At that point, he started to laugh and say, oh, the story was great. I just want to know if you want to be my law clerk when you graduate. That a year later, I graduated and started a wonderful adventure, a year and a half clerkship with the judge.
You know, some people would have run away screaming from an invitation like that. But I mean, what was he like as a boss, as you worked for him as a clerk?
He's a great boss because it was a combination of his judicial attitude, which was helping the little guy. You heard that clip about him growing up fighting and taking on bullies. And he brought that attitude with him when he was on the bench. And so every day you felt like you were actually getting to help people who really needed help. And the judge really emphasized that and made sure that his whole chambers was in line with that philosophy. But he was also fun, and we had a great, great time. He was always laughing, really enjoyed life so much. So it was a great combination of doing good and having fun at the same time.
He didn't pull his punches, though, when he saw something he didn't like. I mean, did that ever rear its head as you were working with him? I mean, the things that you were doing?
Well, as a boss, he was always very protective of his clerks. There were three law clerks. I was one of three when I worked for him. And as bold as he was and as controversial and outspoken as he was, he treated us great, like friends and family. But I certainly heard his views on cases and the world at large while I was clerking for him. He was very outspoken about his beliefs. He didn't try and hide what he was doing, which often got him in trouble with his superiors and other judges.
We actually have a call already from Larry in Minneapolis. Good morning, Larry.
Hi.
You have a question and a thought?
Well, just a couple of thoughts. I clerked with Judge McLaughlin, whose chambers were next to Judge Lord, and so I ran into him in the elevator, and I always thought he was just really kind and friendly to us little people. And then I had a case with him very early as an attorney, and I really liked how he expressed himself emotionally in the decision. It involved the Reagan administration cutting people off of disability benefits programs and kind of violating the law in the process. And he could have just said, well, that was wrong, and we're going to give these benefits. It was a kid who had a degenerative disease who was pretty clearly disabled, and the government had kind of held up for a number of years on those benefits. And he just said kind of rhetorically, what kind of agency can call itself Health and Human Services when it does something to someone who's so clearly disabled? And I think that sent maybe a little message to the agency that, you violate the law, and we're going to hold you accountable even if you're really big and this person on the other side is really little. And I appreciated that.
Thank you for calling today. He really was about sending messages sometimes.
Yeah, he believed that it was not enough to simply issue an order and let the order take its course on the parties involved in the litigation. He wanted to send messages to government agencies, as this caller just pointed out. He wanted to send messages to corporations that had been harming people, and he wanted the general public to also know what he was doing. He felt it was very important to speak to the person on the street and not just to other judges and lawyers.
We actually have a little piece of tape here, again, from one of those interviews from the 1980s, where he talks about his thoughts about corporations. So let's listen to that now.
I don't want to be thought of as denouncing corporations as an institution. They're wonderful. Sometimes if you criticize one corporation, others take it to heart. Well, you can criticize a dope peddler or a mugger, a slugger, a thug. Does that make you anti-people? Mm-hmm. But corporations seem to say if you criticize one, you're a threat to all. So they get together like the musk ox, rumps together and horns out when the wolves come after. You've probably seen the pictures.
The musk ox, what a great what a great image. I mean, you when you signed on, you obviously knew of his reputation, but were you aware of how his history stretched back so long? Because you started working with him in the early
1983.
Yeah,
right. Well, as a journalist, I certainly was aware of Miles because he was such great copy. He issued so many big opinions and was so colorful and outspoken. So I certainly knew about him. I had a year in between the time of that early morning phone call and when my clerkship started. And if it was a slow night in the newsroom, I would go back to the newsroom library, the morgue, and start reading the old clips about the judge, going back to the 1950s. So I was aware of his background generally, but I delved into it much more in the 5 years I spent working on the book.
We are talking with Roberta Walburn. She is the author of a new biography called Miles Lord, the Maverick Judge Who Brought Corporate America to Justice. You can join our conversation by calling 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Now, you came on board just as the Dalkin Shield suit was heating up. And, I'm actually kind of amazed. I moved to the state around about that time, and it was everyone was talking about it, but now it's kind of been forgotten a little, I think. But why was it such a big deal?
Well, the Dalkon Shield IUD in the early 1970s was the biggest selling IUD in the country. It had 80% of the market, a huge seller.
We're talking tens, hundreds of thousands
hundreds,
of women?
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands of women had this.
Actually, millions. Okay. Millions.
And it was internationally sold?
Sold to 79, 80 countries around the world. But it had a deadly flaw, which was a multifilament tail string that wicked bacteria up into the uterus, caused horrendous infections in women. Many lost their infertility. Some lost their lives. The litigation had started in the early 1970s and had been going on for 10, 11 years in front of other judges around the country. The company that manufactured the Dalkon Shield, the A.H. Robbins Company of Richmond, Virginia, no longer with us, but at that time was a Fortune 500 company. And it had been able to delay and stonewall hiring more than 100 law firms around the country to defend the Dalkon Shield. And just coincidentally, when my clerkship started in the fall of 1983, Judge Lord took on the first of his Dalkon Shield cases. It was a collection of 21 cases. And the short story is, after 11 years of litigation in front of other judges, in 3 months, Judge Lord essentially blew the litigation out of the water.
And he did this by taking what some people would say is an unorthodox approach. I mean, he actually went in and took depositions himself.
He presided over depositions that the attorneys were taking. The judge was very hands-on, and in one respect, it was unorthodox what he was doing, but from a lawyer's perspective. But from a layperson's perspective, what he was doing would seem just to be common sense. He opened up the pretrial discovery so that the plaintiff's attorneys could take depositions of the highest-ranking officials of the company and go after documents that had been hidden, including secret studies of the tail string. And he also said, instead of trying 21 cases one case at a time for months at a time, I'm going to try all my 21 cases together. Again, it makes perfect sense to a layperson. You've got the same product injuring women in the same way. Why have to waste 4 or 5 months in trial for each and every case?
It's an extraordinary case as you read the details in your book. And part of it, too, is just the way the attitude of the A.H. Robbins attorneys towards the plaintiffs, towards the women who had faced these horrible, horrible consequences of using the Dalkon Shield, and the way that they were humiliated. I mean, there were the so-called dirty questions, which looked at their sexual history and practices, and even how they used toilet tissue. I mean, what was the impact of those questions on the cases?
Those questions, called the dirty questions, a litany of questions about women's sexual practices and personal practices, intimidated many women. Some women either would not sue or drop their lawsuits because they didn't want to have to go through that ringer. And again, one of the common sense things that Judge Lord did in the very first hearing on the Dalkon Shield cases was he said, those questions are out of my cases. You're not going to ask them in my court unless you have very specific proof of how they're relevant to this particular woman. And I think the exact legal terms he used to rule on that was forget it. Wasn't going to happen in his courtroom.
Now, you were, it has to be said, a relative novice in the legal field when you were working on this, and you found yourself in the thick of things. He actually sent you to Richmond, Virginia, to go over discovery of documents.
Right. I mean, I was a newbie. I was just out of law school, but I'd been a journalist for a number of years. And that experience of digging out facts certainly helped me. And Miles was a very hands-on judge. So, instead of just issuing orders, he would get on a plane himself and go down to Richmond to supervise depositions. And he sent me down to help two special masters find documents that had been hidden. I really had no idea what I was doing.
It must have been terrifying.
It was scary and exciting at the same time. You know, as a journalist, you want to be in the center of action. And here I was right in the thick of things. And I'd also learned as a journalist to show no fear, even if you were shaking in your boots. So that those lessons certainly helped me.
Of course, in a way, you didn't really get to, from the journalistic point of view, you didn't really get to write about it until now, though.
Right.
It was a little frustrating, maybe?
No, I mean, it took me 30 years to come back to it, but I think it was worth the wait.
So the case dragged on, even despite the expedited approach that he took. It dragged on for a number of months, and there was just incredible amount of legal maneuvering, but ultimately the cases reached settlement, and then an extraordinary thing happened. There was a speech.
Right. The cases actually never got to trial in front of Miles. He postponed the trial to allow the discovery to go forward, and meanwhile, the company was trying furiously to settle the 21 cases that were in front of the judge to escape from his grasp. And when the last of the cases settled, the judge said, well, I want one final settlement hearing, and I want three top officers from the company to appear personally before me. He didn't really have the power to order them to come, but that didn't really stop him either. And they did show up in his courtroom, and he prepared a blistering speech to try and reach out to them as people, not as corporate officers, but as people, to plead with them to do the right thing, which was to recall the Dalkon Shield because thousands of women were still wearing it, and also to compensate the women who had been injured. And the speech packed a wallop, and it even though the cases were then finished in front of the judge, they were going on in front of other judges around the country who really the speech went, as we would say today, went viral. It was reprinted verbatim in newspapers and magazines across the country, in the Congressional Record. Other judges heard it and really took up the torch on discovery and took up the case where Miles had left off. The company, on the other hand, filed judicial misconduct charges against the judge as a result of that speech.
You were in the court that day. I mean, it sounds like it must have been just electrifying.
It was. Miles was quite an actor and loved to think of things in theatrical terms. In addition to being a street fighter when he was growing up in Crosby Ironton, he was also the lead male role in virtually every high school play. So he saw things in terms of drama, and not just for drama's sake, but in order to get his message out. And the courtroom that day, the judge hadn't decided whether he was going to read his speech out loud or hand it to them to read in private. He ended up reading it out loud, and it was you could hear a pin drop, and you could also hear periodically some of the women victims who were in the courtroom sobbing during the speech. It was a very powerful, emotional moment.
There was a firestorm afterwards. As you mentioned, this was also the CBS broadcast that
right.
came out of that. He was on 60 Minutes thinking that, I mean, I don't know if he maybe thought for a moment it was a misstep when it actually happened, but 60 Minutes came out to do a piece about him, and he thought it was going to be kind of a puff piece.
Yes.
And then he saw the broadcast itself.
Right. He thought it was going to be a puff piece. Mike Wallace did the interview. The journalist in me is thinking, you know, I'm not so sure, Judge, this is going to be that light a touch. And sure enough, when the program aired, Mike Wallace was pretty harsh on the judge. The judge also didn't do himself any favors. I mean, he was very outspoken, looked very fierce. And the judge, when he watched it, was kind of taken aback, and I hadn't really seen him that way at all during the time I had clerked for him. But within a couple weeks, letters started flooding in from ordinary people across the country. And as usual, Miles had the common touch and could speak to people. He just had a way of reaching people and having people understand the message. And the letters lauding him and thanking him for everything he had done just started pouring into his chambers and to 60 Minutes. And he turned out to be quite proud of that program.
I'm talking with Roberta Walburn. She's a former journalist who has worked as a lawyer for 25 years. She's also the author of a new biography, Miles Lord, the Maverick Judge Who Brought Corporate America to Justice. You can join our conversation by calling 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. She will also be reading at the Zenith Bookstore in Duluth on Saturday. Is that in the morning? Or
that will be at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
3 o'clock in the afternoon. We have a couple of people on the line, and we have Rob from St. Paul, who wanted to talk a little about Miles Lord's political history. Good morning, Rob.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thank you. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Back in the 1980s, I had a chance to meet Judge Lord on many occasions and talk about his history. I was doing some research on the Minnesota farmer labor movement, and I was able to convince the judge that he should give me time to talk about it. The one thing I thought was really interesting is that he was close friends with both Hubert Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy. And he talked about in the 60s how they used to travel together on the bus, and McCarthy would give these big philosophical, poetic, wonderfully embracing kind of speeches. And then he would stand down, and then Hubert would get up and give the sort of brass tacks, like, we got to beat him kind of speech, the coach-like speech. And he said that they were a 1-2 punch that could not be matched anywhere in the country. And Miles, of course, was the clown. He was on the bus, and he was telling jokes, and he was getting everybody psyched up for the next stop in whatever small town around the state of Minnesota. But what really became very telling for me was when he said in 1968, when they went to the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and it was Humphrey versus McCarthy, and he said the entire Minnesota party was torn down the middle. And he said, both of these men were very, very close friends of Miles. And he was sort of jumping from one side to the other and trying to talk to both of them about what was going on. And he told me about how, the Clean for Gene kids came from all over the country, and they were getting their heads bloodied in the streets of Chicago. And it was very disturbing, and the McCarthy people were ripping up the bed sheets in the hotel and wrapping kids' heads that had been beat over the head and were bleeding. And he said he was really troubled by that. And he went to talk to Gene and just encouraged McCarthy to stay the course and do the right thing and be the moral voice for the party. And then he went and talked to Humphrey, and they stood on this terrace overlooking Grant Park, and they could see the fighting. And Miles told me, he turned to Hubert Humphrey and said, Hubert, let's go out into the streets and talk to the kids. And everybody around Humphrey and all the Secret Service are like, no, that's like crazy. You can't do that. There's no possible way. And Humphrey said to Miles, the nomination is on the floor, and I have to go to the floor. And Miles responded to Humphrey by saying, but the election is out in the streets. If you want to win the elections, we go out onto the streets.
It's a press.
I thought that was really, really telling. It was telling about Miles as a person, as where his sympathies lie and the people he wanted to talk to about the issues that were facing the country at that time.
Well, Roberta, you cover this situation at length,
right,
in the book, and the way that Miles Lord was tugged between these two people who had been very, very close friends, but were torn apart by the war.
Right. 1968 was a year that tore the country apart over the Vietnam War. It was also a year that tore these friendships These three men had met in the 1940s before there was even a DFL, when the Democrats were the lowly third party also-rans, and together had forged a liberal dynasty. Miles considered Hubert to be his brother and was very close friends with Eugene McCarthy. And here they were in 1968 going at each other, representing opposite ends of the party and the country. And Miles appointed himself what he called the unofficial envoy between the two campaigns, trying to bring some peace to them. And his grand vision was to have Hubert be president and Eugene be vice president. And there was actually serious consideration given to that. And as part of the research for the book, I found letters from Miles in 1968. He'd spend time with the McCarthy campaign and then write a long letter to Hubert about what was going on, and then spend a lot of time with Hubert's campaign. Both candidates knew he was going back and forth, so they were kind of using him to pass on information. Of course, as a judge, he had been appointed 2 years earlier. He shouldn't have been involved in partisan politics at all, but he was ready to give up his judgeship for the grand vision he had of the party.
Mm-hmm. We actually have a little piece of tape from one of the interviews where he talked about his political roots, because, I mean, ultimately he was a very political guy, and let's hear that now.
Basically, my roots in politics, which all judges must have to get appointed, lay with Gene McCarthy, and Hubert Humphrey was one of my best friends. Walter Mondale, who used to be my assistant when I was Attorney General. I'm more from that breed of cats. Mm-hmm. I'm not a warmonger. I love my fellow man. I believe that we are our brothers and sisters' keeper, and that blessed are the meek.
A little bit of biblical
well,
there.
and it was often said that Miles would have been as good a preacher as he was a judge. He had that social gospel philosophy of taking care of your brothers and your sisters and helping the least fortunate among us.
But this really came from his early experience on the Iron Range, growing up on the range, and then his involvement in this new party that kind of arrived out of the amalgamation of two actually warring bodies.
Right. I mean, growing up on the range, he was quite taken with the sermons he heard in church, and he heard the story of Cain and Abel. And in his young boy's mind, it was Cain pushing Abel into an iron ore pit from which he couldn't escape. But when the question was asked, am I my brother's keeper, Miles had the answer, and that was yes. The young men, and they were all men at that time, who coalesced under Hubert's leadership in the 40s to form the DFL, were all very much of that same mindset, that they were going to help the least fortunate members of our society.
We should talk a little about the other huge case that attracted a lot of attention in Minnesota, the reserve mining case, where he got into similar hot water.
Seems to be a theme here.
Yeah, it seems to be a theme. And this was reserve mining had been hailed as a savior, bringing lots of jobs to the Iron Range when it began converting taconite or creating taconite, but it was dumping the tailings from the process into Lake Superior, thousands and thousands of tons every day. And I get the impression that he went in actually not feeling he went into that case not feeling like he was going to lean one way or the other.
Right, which surprised me. I didn't know that history when I started the book. The reserve mining case was filed in 1972. The company was dumping 67,000 tons of asbestos-like material into the lake every day. Citizens of Duluth and other North Shore communities were drinking that water unfiltered. But Miles, being a son of the Iron Range, knew many of the people who had those good jobs up there. They were boys, now men, who he had grown up with. Some were relatives. And he was very conflicted. In fact, when the case was first filed, the government lawyers who were suing Reserve considered disqualifying the judge for prejudice. They thought he was biased in favor of Reserve. But over a couple years of pretrial proceedings and then the trial, the judge came to the conclusion that there was no option but to have reserve stop the lake dumping and move to an on-land facility where the waste could be contained.
And it, we could talk about this for a long time. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. But he eventually just he shut the plant down.
He issued,
at very short notice.
Yes, there was a dramatic another dramatic courtroom scene with Miles. Saturday session. He would go 7 days a week when he was revved up on a case. He had the top officers of the parent companies in courtroom when they dug their heels in. He was ready to give them time to convert to on-land disposal, but when they dug their heels in, he issued an order saying shut down by midnight tonight.
And that, I mean, you talk about a firestorm.
Yeah, well, that order lasted just about as long as it took the lawyers to get to the Eighth Circuit, which was less than 48 hours. The Eighth Circuit reversed that order, and eventually the Eighth Circuit removed him from the case. Quote that you referenced earlier in the program about shedding the robes of a judge and assuming the mantle of the advocate came from the Eighth Circuit decision, removing the judge from the case. But ultimately, he was proven right when the next judge who came in also ordered reserve to stop the lake dumping, albeit with a longer time horizon to convert.
There's another piece of tape I'd like to play, which is about his belief about his most important ruling during a very long career. Let's just listen in. It's this is the case he considered the most important.
I ruled that high schools must furnish as much money for women's athletic activities as it did for boys' athletic activities. If you see, and I explain, if you see a girls' high school basketball tournament now, or you see women in high school tennis or track or volleyball or whatever, it's all came from that one opinion. That's an amazing opinion that I was coerced by my daughter and my sister into writing it. My daughter did call me and she said, "Daddy, you'll be careful on that." And so I be'd careful and I wrote the opinion and I'm very proud of it. I get a lump in my throat every time I open the page and look at the girls in high school athletic activities.
Now, it has to be said that he was, I think, a male chauvinist, basically, at least early on.
That's by his own admission he was. But this is another case as in reserve where he changed his mind after the case came to him. He issued an opinion that allowed girls to compete on boys' teams. And it really helped open the door. And then Title IX came in shortly after that that helped girls participate in athletics. And I think the judge had a special place in his heart for that case because he would see his granddaughters playing hockey with the boys and slamming the boys around on the ring, and he took no end of joy in that.
Strangely enough, we just received a phone call from a Virginia in Wayzata. Virginia Lords, good morning.
Good morning. Miles with my father.
Hi, Virginia.
Hi, Roberta. I just want to say that the book is absolutely fantastic. Roberta was able to capture the spirit of my father's main goal in life, which was to help those who, for whatever reason, couldn't help themselves or represent themselves. And her book is extremely accurate and very suspenseful.
It is indeed. It is a fascinating read.
Well, and let me just say that Virginia and her sister Priscilla, when I started out on this project, gave me access to the judge's private papers. And I told them at the time that this was not an authorized biography and they would have no right to edit or review the book before its final version. And I also told them it wouldn't be a puff piece, that Miles certainly generated his share of controversy and you couldn't tell his life without telling that. And given all that, eternal thanks for them for still giving me the keys to the family storage unit.
Thanks very much for calling in today, Virginia.
Thank you. Bye.
We also have a question. Jesse, who's been very patient, hanging on from Lakeville. He has, I think, a very pressing question. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was wondering. I'm hearing about this. Miles Lord is a name I'm rather disappointed in myself. I didn't know much about. I knew the name. I didn't know the history. my number one question, and it revolves around a personal matter. I'm a part of a labor union, an advocate for one. We have a case against the Minnesota Timberwolves where we were accusing them of misclassifying their employees. It got ruled in the Timberwolves' favor here in a local labor board. We appealed it to the federal labor board. The federal labor board overturned it. The thing that's really bothering us now is there's no one to enforce these rules. Now that the federal labor board has said, yes, the Timberwolves were misclassifying these 1099 employees, they're supposed to be paid as W-2, we find there's no one to enforce it, which leads me to the question.
We're running a little out of time here.
Is there a current day Miles Lord? Is there anyone who followed in his footsteps so you could point to and say these people modeled themselves after this amazing man?
We just have 30 seconds.
Yeah, there wasn't a present day Miles Lord when he was on the bench. I mean, he was one of a kind. And there's certainly no one like him on the bench today.
Roberta Welberg, thank you very much for coming in today. The new biography is Miles Lord, the Maverick Judge Who Brought Corporate America to Justice. She'll be reading from the book at the Zenith Bookstore on Saturday afternoon in Duluth. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.